Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. We're going back in time on this edition, way back. Northwest Regional Correspondent Tom Bonsey talks about an archaeological dig in Oregon resurrecting artifacts from the Rogue River Indian War. Researchers in Portland are teaming with the University of Victoria, British Columbia, and their work is resetting theories on the durability of biological evidence. And just in time, paleontologists have unearthed a T-Rex skull. This animal is believed to have lived about 66 million years ago. All that and more on The Bridge. The Veterans Administration is still working to shorten wait times for patients to get medical care, but one of its latest proposals has some doctors upset. It would allow specially trained nurses to treat patients in some specialties without a doctor's oversight. Patricia Murphy has the report.
The proposed rule concerns what are known as advanced practice registered nurses. That includes nurse practitioners, clinical nurse specialists, and certified registered nurse anesthetists, people who've had advanced training in a particular specialty. Right now, in many VA medical centers, they can only see patients if they're supervised by a doctor, but under the proposal, they could work independently. The VA's Penny K. Jensen, who's a nurse practitioner, says that would standardize the VA system. It would help reduce staffing shortages and get veterans seen more quickly.
If nurse practitioners were able to function to the level of their education, training, and certification, we would be able to see patients in a more timely manner. We would be able to decrease those wait times in primary care.
The rule would allow all of the VA's nearly 6,000 advanced practice registered nurses, depending on their credentials, to do routine checkups, manage chronic conditions like diabetes, and provide anesthesia. Jensen says within the VA, those types of nurses now operate under the laws of whatever state they're licensed in, which is inconsistent across the country, and even can lead to inconsistent care in the same hospital.
So we may have a nurse practitioner practicing in Colorado, and they may be practicing on a Georgia license, but they would have to follow the regulations of that Georgia license.
Jensen says the policy would bring the VA in line with the Department of Defense, the Indian Health Service, and civilian hospitals in some states. But physicians groups say the change would give some nurses too much authority over patient care. American Society of Anesthesiologists President-elect Dr. Jeffrey Plagenhoff says the VA hasn't done conclusive research on how complex surgeries might be impacted.
Anesthesiology is inherently dangerous, and it becomes even more dangerous as sickness increases. So veterans are more likely to have had heart attacks, strokes, emphysema, congestive heart failure, and conditions such as those, which dramatically increase the likelihood of problems before, during, and after surgeries.
But nurses reject the assertion that VA patients are too complex for nurse anesthetists to manage safely. Juan Quintana is president of the American Association of Nurse Anesthetists. He says they've already proven they can work independently in the operating room.
I personally work in a rural facility in Northeast Texas, and that is the model of practice that we utilize today. And it is very effective, very safe. Our outcomes are amazing. We take care of patients in all ages, all types of surgeries, for all kinds of procedures, without any difficulty whatsoever.
Since the proposal was announced, more than 200,000 comments, including 50,000 paper comments, have poured into the federal government, far more than is typical for a proposed policy change. The VA hasn't finished tabulating them yet. Once they do, the VA Undersecretary for Health will decide whether there's a policy change, but it likely will be a while before that happens. I'm Patricia Murphy reporting.
In-home health care providers in Washington State have traveled a long road to get to where they are now. In the latest contract negotiations, the state has agreed to the biggest pay raise yet for these workers. By the end of their contract in 2019, the average wage for caregivers paid by the state will top $16 an hour. Melissa Ringer is a caregiver and a member of the Service Employees International Union Healthcare 775 team at the bargaining table. She says the new contract legitimizes her profession in ways she hasn't seen before.
It's a respectable field. It's something that I'm not ashamed or embarrassed to say that I do anymore, because I felt like we were considered glorified babysitters. These wins help caregivers to produce better caregivers.
State contracted caregivers represented in this contract work with elderly patients, children with disabilities, and even include some parents who provide care for their adult children with disabilities. Ringer says they'll now look to the Washington legislature to ensure the new contract is funded for 2017. The contract also includes an increase in paid time off, doubling the retirement funding from the state, and a 50-cent per hour raise for caregivers who complete certain advanced training. As the average age of Washington population rises rapidly, Ringer says politicians are now changing how they see at-home givers.
The baby boomers are aging out, and a lot of our politicians are now seeing this real world, what's happening with their families. Family members need to be taken care of, and we want good quality caregivers to go in your home, and this contract helps us to produce those.
Oregon state authorities and forest officials say at least 14 wildfires that have erupted across central Oregon over the last 3 weeks are believed to have been intentionally started. Officials did not release details on which fires were started by arsonists, but they're urging the public to report suspicious activity. Authorities say it's too early to tell if one or several people have been starting the fires. Two men suspected of starting a wildfire last year that scorched 40 square miles of Oregon forest land could soon get a bill for at least $37 million. Jeff Bonebrake with the Oregon Department of Forestry says they're still finalizing firefighting costs for the 2015 Stouts Creek fire that burned east of Canyonville. The agency will send a bill once that's done. Oregon holds individuals financially responsible for fire suppression costs. Bonebrake says people can challenge the costs or their responsibility in the fire. In southeast Washington, the Range 12 fire is good and out. But now there's 176,000 acres of black. It's roasted much of the valuable habitat on the Hanford Reach National Monument. Correspondent Anna King took this journey into the black.
Heidi Newsom unlocks a tangle of padlocks, then pushes open the 118 gate. She's a federal wildlife biologist, and she's closely managed this dramatic landscape for nearly two decades. But now, this place she loves for its beauty and solitude feels greatly disturbed, eerie. We roll into the reach. Everything's gone, shadowed with black ash.
It was a little frustrating, and I was upset.
Newsom is the one who's developing a plan to restore as much of this habitat as funding allows. Usually, it's beautiful here. It's long been a tightly protected swath of land. First, an enforced security buffer around the Hanford nuclear site. In 2000, it was set aside as a protected federal monument. That's kept it from grazing, the plow, and development. Within its bounds, Rattlesnake Mountain and the last undammed stretch of the Columbia River. It's been home to hundreds of elk and dwindling species like sage grouse and burrowing owls. Now a lot of that's gone.
I've cried before, and I'll probably cry again after I get over the shock of what's happened.
Our first stop, a burnt up desert oasis called Rattlesnake Springs. We have to hike there.
Wow, you can smell the char out here.
Yeah, it smells like ash and dust.
We weave through stark greasewood shrubs and grass and sand. Sweat and dust mingle on my face, finally.
So it's like a huge canyon, kind of like a grotto, and there's these beautiful trees. What kind of trees are these, Heidi?
These are mostly Pacific willows, and there's some black cottonwoods. They're coyote willows.
This once lush place is all fed by an ancient underground spring. A few of the spring's trees have managed to escape the fire, but a large chunk of this oasis isn't suited for flocks of migrating birds anymore. Back in the truck and further along, Newsom negotiates deeply rutted sandy roads and the ash. Usually there are sagebrush, bunch grass, and desert crust here. Now there's nothing holding the talcum-like topsoil. Newsom says dust storms are already popping up, and there will be running mud later on when the rain and snow hit. Still, some are benefiting from all this destruction, for now. A half-eaten dead snake tells the tale. This guy, small mammals and lizards, have little cover from raptors like hawks and owls.
They'll have a lot of prey for a short time, and then it's going to be very little prey for a long, long time until this recovers.
Recovery time? That's the problem. Newsom says fire is coming too often. Should be every 50 to 80 years, not every 5 to 10. The slow-growing desert species here can't recover.
It's just one of those things, I guess, that you pick yourself up again and go on, you know.
For her, that means planting trees, protecting them from the elk with tall fences, and planting pencil-high sagebrush. Two previous fires left her with 50,000 acres to restore. On this burn, she's hoping for money enough to deal with about 10% of what's been blackened. I'm Anna King, outside of Richland.
That's the sound of the marbled murrelet. After a year-long review of more than 1.5 million acres of critical habitat for the marbled murrelet in Oregon, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has determined the habitat is still integral to the species' long-term survival. The marbled murrelet, a small potato-shaped seabird that nests in old-growth forests along the northwest coast, was listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act in 1992. Elizabeth Materna from the Oregon Office of Fish and Wildlife said the decision won't hurt the interests of private landowners on the coast.
Fish and Wildlife Services continues to find collaborative solutions to conserving wildlife resources while also supporting strong local economy.
In response to litigation and redefinition of critical habitat, Fish and Wildlife conducted a voluntary review in 2015 of more than 3.5 million acres of critical habitat in Oregon, Washington, and California. Most of the dedicated critical habitat is located on federal lands. According to Fish and Wildlife numbers from 2014, there are about 1,100 marbled murrelets, also known as the fog lark, still left in Oregon. Nick Cady of the environmental group Cascadia Wildlands said the species is very sensitive to any fragmentation of its habitat, especially from logging, which puts the small bird at risk of predation.
The huge concerning thing with the marbled murrelet is while their numbers have relatively remained steady over the past, I believe, 5 to 10 years, the truly alarming thing is that there's an incredible lack of juveniles, which shows that the species is not really breeding anymore.
And although the reaffirmation of critical habitat by Fish and Wildlife is a win for the little bird, Katie says it may not be as significant as it seems at first glance. He says because the agency looks at habitats on a large scale, it can offer small portions of land to private interests without significant loss to the total acreage protected. But small parcels of critical habitat left unprotected can have big consequences for species such as the murrelet.
Numerous court rulings over the past decade have upheld this ability of the Fish and Wildlife to analyze adverse impacts to critical habitat based on these enormous scales. And that has effectively gutted any practical benefits to critical habitat designations.
You're listening to The Bridge. Perhaps you remember a family trip back east or to the American South where you visited a Civil War battlefield or two. These national parks and pilgrimage sites receive hundreds of thousands of visitors annually. During the decade before the U.S. Civil War, a different conflict made a big impact on the Oregon Territory's future. It's known as the Rogue River Indian War. You'd be hard-pressed to find or tour those battlefields. Now a series of archaeological investigations is resurrecting this Northwest history.
The Rogue River Indian War was an uprising against miners and settlers in southwest Oregon in the mid-1850s. There were massacres, reprisals, pitched battles, and a final forced expulsion of native tribes from their homelands to distant reservations. Looking back from 160 years later, two things stand out. Artifacts from the mostly forgotten battles lie just beneath the surface, and the human interest in the conflict among descendants and neighbors takes minimal prodding to unearth, too. First, the digging. A team organized by Southern Oregon University just wrapped up a month-long excavation near Gold Beach on the Oregon coast.
Ooh. There's the burn.
The SOU team investigated the former Geisel homestead, where a family of German immigrants were slain or taken hostage by tribal warriors. A few miles away, the archaeologists, led by Professor Mark Tveskov, uncovered the foundations of a crude earthen fort. Here, native forces laid siege to more than 100 settlers and miners for a month until the U.S. Army arrived.
You can see things that you don't see just from the written word, like the desperation of the people in Miner's Fort is not captured in any pioneer memoir, where they crafted a kind of heroic picture of what happened. And here we could see them cowering in a cabin, being rained on by musket balls, burning their wagons and whaleboats to the last piece of hardware, you know, and that's a material record.
The investigators say they were surprised by how many artifacts they found in what is now a privately held pasture. Project archaeologist Chelsea Rose shows me one of her favorites, a broken chunk of imitation cut crystal.
I love these because they're absolutely impractical. They're heavy, they're bulky, they're breakable, they're everything you wouldn't think you'd want inside this fort.
Rose says she can relate to the unknown frontier family who, in their moment of desperation, chose to flee with a cherished leaded glass bowl.
We live in an area that's high fire, so I've had to evacuate twice for fire. And what did I bring? Basically the equivalent of this, like photo albums, paintings, you know, nothing practical.
While the archaeologists and summer field school students work, they receive a steady trickle of visitors bearing questions, stories, or artifacts collected long ago. The cultural resources director for the Siletz tribe visited several times. Robert Kenta says for tribal folks, the history of the Indian War is not that old. His grandmother's father lived through it.
You know, that's very fresh in our family stories, you know, how he, by some miracle, was able to survive the wars as an orphan boy, spending that last winter in a kind of hollowed out sugar pine snag, you know, just scraping, getting by.
Kenta says it's difficult to be reminded of all the suffering people went through on both sides, but he and other tribal visitors came to support the excavation.
It's part of that reconciling of the past with where we're at today and understanding what your family has been through and your whole community has been through. And in some ways it can help you navigate towards a healthier future.
It's these kinds of reactions that motivate archaeologists Veskoff and Rose.
Everything we do as archaeologists, we're always trying to get back to the people. All these artifacts, you know, they're fun to look at, but really they're a means to an end, and that's to tell us the human story.
Last month, the National Park Service awarded the university nearly $100,000 to survey several more Rogue River Indian War sites and then tie it all together with a National Register of Historic Places nomination. Tveskov hopes that eventually raises the profile of the battlefields and leads to better conservation and interpretation. I'm Tom Bonsi near Gold Beach, Oregon.
A Portland testing lab and a research team led by the University of Victoria, British Columbia, have reset assumptions about the durability of biological evidence. Try wrapping your head around 250,000 years. Correspondent Tom Bonsi explains.
Archaeologist April Noel of Victoria, Canada, shipped home a trove of Stone Age cutting tools uncovered during a dig at an oasis in the Jordanian desert. Noel was curious if microscopic residue on those tools could prove what early humans were butchering and eating. It was an expensive gamble, though, to send a selection to a private lab for testing. John Fagan runs the Portland lab, Archaeological Investigations Northwest.
Well, given the age of the artifacts, it was pretty interesting. The protein residues were preserved on artifacts that were estimated to be 250,000 years old.
In fact, really amazing, says Fagan. He says before this, the oldest blood residue processed in his lab was barely over 10,000 years old. A fraction of the newly examined tools tested positive for blood proteins of camel, rhinoceros, duck, wild horse, and cattle. The researchers described their findings this week in the peer-reviewed Journal of Archaeological Science. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
And speaking of amazing discoveries, paleontologists with Seattle's Burke Museum have unearthed the bones of a Tyrannosaurus rex that lived more than 66 million years ago. The remarkable discovery includes a fairly complete 4-foot-long skull, vertebrae, ribs, hips, and lower jaw bones, and represents about 20% of the meat-eating dinosaur. Scientists worked over the summer to excavate the bones in the Hell Creek Formation in Montana. The skull was encased in a protective plaster cast, loaded onto a flatbed truck, and driven to Seattle, where it was unloaded at the Burke Museum last week. Scientists estimate the dinosaur is 85% the size of the largest T-Rex discovered. This one may have lived about 15 years. The museum says there are only 14 other nearly complete T-Rex skulls that have been found. Burke paleontologists plan to return to the site next summer.
And when I die, and when I'm dead and gone, there'll be one child born and a world to carry on. There'll be one child born to carry. I'm not scared of dying, and I don't really care if it's peace or finding dying. Well, then let the time be near if it's peace or finding dying.
In our final feature this morning, Tiffany Eckert introduces us to a woman in Eugene. Her mission is to resurrect an old practice for dealing with the dead. More people are choosing alternative ways to spend the hereafter, and that includes natural burial, which means no embalming or encasement in non-biodegradable packaging. Tiffany Eckert has more.
Cynthia Beale was looking for a new thing. It was 2004. She'd just sold her successful natural foods grocery in Eugene and wondered what venture she should embark upon next.
I thought to myself, what is going to happen to our bodies when we die? What do we do? How do we dispose of ourselves? What do we do with us? That was just a really fascinating question.
Beale started writing a business plan. She named her new entity the Natural Burial Company and submitted paperwork. 2 weeks later, she received some jarring news.
I find out I've got a tumor. And so I go into this really interesting mode for about 4 months of possibly being my first and last customer.
At the time, Beale says the idea of a modern natural burial was virtually unheard of. Her friends said her ideas wouldn't work. She heard from skeptics who told her embalming and concrete vaults were required for burial in Oregon. She just said no way and wrote her own burial plan.
I basically said, when I die, I don't want to be embalmed. I want to be buried in the ground, shallow, so I can decompose. I want to be in a biodegradable coffin. I want to have a cherry tree planted on top of me.
The successful surgery removed the cancer. What remained was a commitment to make it easier for other people to plan and carry out a natural burial. 12 years later, Beale's Natural Burial Company offers consultation and sells organic coffins, caskets, and urns. The materials include willow, bamboo, even paper, all biodegradable. There was a time in this country when every burial was natural. During the Civil War, the need to transport dead soldiers home led to the practice of embalming bodies for preservation. To this day, a traditional burial usually includes embalming. And that, says Beale, is a problem.
The bodies are not decomposing.
Beale extended her promotion of natural burial when she purchased two cemeteries, one in Junction City and another just west of Eugene. Oak Hill Cemetery has a view of Fern Ridge Reservoir. Some of the headstones date back to the late 1800s. Conventional thought is that unpreserved buried bodies are detrimental to the environment. Many cemeteries require vaults or grave liners for interment. Walking between graves, Beale points out patches of dead grass.
For example, this is a rocky hillside. That's where the burials have taken place with the bodies in the metal caskets inside concrete vaults. And so the soil is not absorbing the water any longer. It's just running off. And then as this hillside bakes in the sun, it kills the grass.
Beale says most cemeteries deal with this problem by using fertilizers and herbicides.
Do you have any idea who established the 6 feet under?
It's a relatively arbitrary choice. At one point, I think the decision was there to deter grave robbers a long time ago from digging into graves. But the 6 foot designation has no scientific basis whatsoever.
For a natural burial at this cemetery, Beale says they dig graves a few feet down.
We like to have 20, 24 inches of soil on top, but they're relatively shallow, and we feel like that is a good compromise between getting the body down good solid depth, but not so far that it inhibits decomposition.
On this day, 20 seventh graders arrive at Oak Hill Cemetery. They're part of SPICE, a science camp for girls.
So we've got, at least half of you have hung out in a cemetery, yeah?
Actually,
all of you have done research in a cemetery, right?
These young scientists are excavating to learn about decomposition. They're not digging up bodies. Beale and her staff have buried pieces of sheep kidney. The students will exhume them and examine the soil under a microscope. Cemetery as classroom. In many parts of Europe, where natural burial is de rigueur, it is customary to reuse a grave many years after the former occupant has decomposed. The United States is just beginning to grapple with overcrowded cemeteries.
We may actually be leaving a tremendous challenge for future generations who may have to disinter all of those boxes and figure out what to do with them.
The city of New York has almost no burial plots left. Metal coffins and cement vaults don't break down, and Beale says that will have grave impacts. Tiffany Eckert reporting.
I didn't come here and I ain't leaving, so don't sit around and cry. Just roll me up and smoke me when I die. I didn't come here and I ain't leaving, so don't sit around and cry. Roll me up and smoke me when I die. Thank y'all very much. We love you. Thank you.
That's all we have time for on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part or just want to hear it again, it is available as a podcast on our website at coastradio.org. I'm Kate Brister. Thank you for listening, and join us next time on The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.